compliance requirements necessary to do business with the government. Today's show will focus on strategies for maximizing both your services and product business lines. Here's your show moderator, Tom Temin.
Our guests today are Bernard Mustafa, Managing Partner of Pleasant Valley Business Solutions, Rich Marksbury, CEO of ROM & Associates, and Christine Zamuda, Director of Strategic Alliances for Microsoft Public Sector. Great to have you on the panel today. And let's get right to it. Product companies going into services for the federal government, especially in the financial area, and sometimes service companies go into product sales. And so why would you want to cross that barrier? What's the advantage? Bernard, why don't we start with you?
Well, Tom, first of all, thank you for inviting me today. And the I would say quite often companies, when they work with the federal government, they see opportunities to grow. And as they see those opportunities, quite often it's around auxiliary services that they can add to their current product. So if a company is providing IT equipment, they quite often can see opportunities in providing services associated with that equipment, including training, consulting in terms of implementations, things like that. So it creates additional product lines, additional opportunities for those customers.
And Rich, your business is accounting systems and compliance. So what's the mix that you have and how do you arrive at that?
Well, you know, it's very similar in that as companies try to expand their businesses into new areas, they often run into issues of compliance with different rules and regulations that the government sets up in order to be a contractor in a specific area. If you're a services contractor, you have more opportunities to run into what are called cost basis type contracts. And it carries a whole range of requirements that all stem from the federal acquisition regulations. And so if you're a product vendor, it might be something that you've set up and done for a while, and you're very familiar with exactly what you need to do in order to operate in that area and get paid. And then you start working in services, and suddenly you run into these new requirements. So my scope is helping companies make sure that they keep those in mind as they leverage the opportunities that Bernard was talking about.
So it sounds like if they're hammering nails, you want to sell them the hammer and great techniques for driving in the nails.
Correct.
And Christine, being a product company, Microsoft has a foundational product for all of this financial management. And do you encourage the people that resell the product to learn to use it and maybe build a product offering around it? How does that all work?
Well, we do have certified partners like Pleasant Valley who provide the solutions to government contractors. I would say the platform facilitates building industry wrappers. What we see actually as a unique offering from a Microsoft Dynamics perspective is there's very few solutions that handle accounting for both products and services. So we found that companies can actually consolidate disparate accounting systems and get more out of their operations as a result.
So in other words, a Pleasant Valley might give the pathway to that consolidation, and having a good accounting system. And in so doing, you happen to be delivering the Microsoft Dynamics platform, but also the value-added services to get people to a better accounting space.
That's correct, Tom. And in addition to that, the keys to the business are a little different. So in a product company, it's very demanding from a transactional standpoint. They have a lot of activity in sales. And so they need software that can help them to streamline their order management process, their quoting processes, a software that can help them with drop shipments, that kind of thing. So we've developed that kind of solution so that a company that is selling has high volume transactions, have the efficiencies they need to be able to not add staff each time they grow.
Okay. Now, Rich, you mentioned the federal acquisition regulations a moment ago, and among those is the encouragement for agencies to use past performance.
Correct.
And so if you are a product vendor, how do you get past the performance issue to go to services or vice versa?
Well, as Bernard mentioned earlier, when you're a product vendor, you often see opportunities that surround what you're doing with your customer. As the customer is a federal agency, you, in delivering product to them, get to know the people you're working with, and they have needs. they're very interested in fulfilling their mission the easiest way possible and making sure that they fulfill their mission in acquisition or whatever they're working in as effectively as possible. And they get to know and you develop relationships. So you get the opportunity to say, okay, I'll give an example. Let's say you're providing laptops and you're selling these computers to a certain agency. And they're sitting there saying, well, I need somebody that can configure these and get them set up in a certain way so that I can deploy those to my people. And you're in the position to say, well, we can offer those services ancillary, as Bernard mentioned, to delivering the product. So you're right in there going along right at the same time.
So it sounds like you can almost take a product one-off sale and turn it into an ongoing business, almost like an annuity.
Correct. But you run into the complication that as you start delivering services, the billing side of it, the delivery side of it is different than what Bernard was talking about with product. With product, you're focused on primarily a single event, really. They're high transactional issues and things to get them done by certain time frames. But usually you develop a sale, you make the sale, and you deliver it. But if you're providing services, it's done over a period of time. And the actual project tracks over a longer period. And so keeping track of that and making sure that you can maybe bill in increments rather than all at once is very important. So the system has to support that kind of thing. And then keeping compliance with federal acquisition regulations and being ready to operate in an environment that the Defense Contract Audit Agency, DCAA, can come out and look at what you're doing, those are the keys to making sure you can bill, get paid, and don't get in trouble for doing something wrong.
Yeah, that got me right to the next question, which is the DCAA, the Defense Contract Auditing Agency, and providers have to be compliant with all their regulations. What does that mean for product companies? It means you probably have to know a little bit more than the product itself, Bernard.
Yeah, that's correct. So quite often the companies, when they are just selling product, they don't have to really worry about DCA as much because they're selling not selling a service. They don't have a lot of labor involved. They're just selling off of a schedule, whether it's a SOUP schedule, GSA schedule, what have you. And once they start getting the services, then it's going to require them to maybe have T&M contracts, cost-plus contracts. They're going to have incurred cost submissions. So there's a lot of expertise that they have to go out and get. And there are firms out there that can help them with their expertise, but it's quite often it's different than what they've done in the past.
And, Christine, if people have good expertise and they have the experience, is the product that they use as the basis for their delivery, can that enable them to be more efficient and faster and maybe more profitable at delivering that service?
Absolutely, Tom. What we've seen, especially with products-based companies, it was pretty interesting dynamics when you look at the rigid accounting system options that are out there. And there's a lot of work outside of the system just to get their jobs done. And we saw in one very kind of funny situation where after we showed what the Dynamics NAV product could do, the head of purchasing and the head of receivables looked at each other and said, oh my God, we could be friends now, because there is so much infighting about making changes and being more creative around getting the invoicing in the format that the government needed. So we find that it can be a real win-win for everyone in the organization.
Yeah, Bernard, do you find that when you're dealing with a federal agency that stovepiped in quality that they have in terms of the different functions, even within finance, or within purchasing, you have receivables and you have payables and you have people that do the physical reception and so forth. Can the service knowledge coupled with a strong product help integrate what the government is doing so they can talk to themselves more effectively?
It's not so much the government, I would say. I would say that inside of the organization, that having one system where the entire organization is looking at the same database, whether it's the purchasing group, whether it's people in accounting or contracts, when everyone's working off the same system, it makes the company much more efficient. And also the quality of the data in the company really is much higher. So we've seen where clients have had two or three actually accounting systems, and they use a lot of Excel spreadsheets, and that leads itself to a lot of error. And so with having one system where you can do products and have services, it really makes them much more effective.
And so, Rich, what are some ways that you can demonstrate that? Maybe because you can't demonstrate past performance all the time, but maybe you can demonstrate future performance by showing how some of those corrections can be made.
Well, when you're really dealing with past performance and future performance type issues, if you're in an area that's new to you and you're starting to fulfill a contract, the easiest one to win is, like we were talking about, the ancillary contracts. But you have really two vehicles that you can get performance under your belt. One is on a cost type contract, DCAA will come out and do what they'll call a pre-award review. In this pre-award review, there's like 15 different things that they look at. And if you can show that you either are compliant with those, mm-hmm. because you've implemented a system like the Pleasant Valley Microsoft Nav system, or you can demonstrate that you have been subsidiary to another provider, and that's the other really vehicle that a lot of contractors use, is they'll go into an area where they have to, where they want to offer services, but they'll actually sub with another company that has more past performance, so they can basically pull in their past performance in order to start operating under the contract.
So what's the best strategy for someone trying to just get into this and expand their business, would you say, from your experience?
Well, I would take a look at the requirements that DCAA really wants to look at to qualify you, and that can be found right on the DCAA website under a form that they fill out when they come out and do this pre-award review called 1408. So the 1408 has like 15 points. You go look at those and see how your system matches up. If you really want a system that can operate in both parameters, it's not really easy to find, and that's the robustness of the NAV system is one of the reasons that I've concentrated a lot of my efforts with my clients on that system, because it doesn't provide the limitations that a system that's focused in services or one that's focused in product has.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break to hear some words from our sponsor. You're listening to the GovCon Straight Talk Show, sponsored by Microsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Microsoft Dynamics is a powerful financial management solution for government contractors. This accounting solution is designed for forward-thinking executives who are interested in more than just meeting DCAA, FAR, and CAS requirements. It is compliance plus. Integrated, easy to use, works the way you do. Microsoft Financial Management Solutions for Government Contractors. You now have a choice in the marketplace. Put simply, Microsoft Dynamics is compliance plus. Visit dynamicsbymicrosoft.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the GovCon Straight Talk Show, sponsored by Microsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin. Our guests today are Rich Marksbury, CEO of ROM & Associates, Bernard Mustafa, Managing Partner for Pleasant Valley Business Solutions, and Christine Zamuda, Director of Strategic Alliances at Microsoft Public Sector. And we're talking about product companies or people that offer a product getting into services. So I wanted to start with you, Rich, and ask you, what are the specific types of services that you see are in demand right now from the federal government?
Well, I think that's a very good question, because they do run the gamut of services at all types, everything from administrative to very technical. One of the things that I see the most of are IT-related services, and that still runs quite a broad spectrum. That's everything from operational IT to help desk to service to very technical implementation type work. What we get into is this broad spectrum of IT services is being demanded by all the different agencies. And so the focus on the current administration is to try to change or shift the amount of work being done by contractors to work being done by employees. So we're seeing some growth in government employees in these areas, but they can only do that so quickly. And so the demand for IT services is very broad, but we're seeing a higher demand for employees that have security clearances in the secret or top secret area. And so any company that's doing that type of work that can get the cleared employees to go into areas that would otherwise be restricted are the highest demands.
And Bernard, what are you seeing, too, in terms of the types of services that government is demanding?
Well, in addition to security and IT security, physical security, also there's a big demand for medical technology. So medical and healthcare technology seems to be an area that's growing pretty rapidly in the marketplace.
Now, last year we had the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, ARRA, the stimulus bill, and that came with all kinds of add-on requirements for accounting and making sure the money was available in terms of how it was spent to the penny, the president said, to the American public. What has that done for the whole market, Bernard?
Well, there's a reporting requirement that any dollar that you received under the stimulus package, you have to report impact on employment, whether additional jobs or saved jobs associated with that. It has to be separated from other kinds of revenue. So within the system, people have to really be able to report that different source of revenue, which was not a requirement before the Recovery Act.
And Rich, what's your take on ARRA? Because it seems to have affected everybody.
Well, I think it has. And with the $800 billion stimulus package that you mentioned, it's about a quarter of it is really designated for government contractors. Again, with the act, the administration has trying to limit the amount of cost basis type contracts and throwing them to more time material based contracts and also some fixed price contracts. They're also promoting work with smaller businesses. That means more businesses that need to ramp up their requirements because they didn't give any of the smaller businesses a break on any of the requirements that they need in order to fulfill that. The reporting requirements and also registration requirements that Bernard was talking about, you know, they're all fairly encapsulated on the government website called recovery.gov. And I would encourage anybody who is even thinking about doing government contracting to go on the site, look at what they need to do to register, because it's not something you just apply for, but contracts that are currently in existence can become suddenly underneath the Recovery Act if the government decides to focus funds in that direction. It's not like you only apply for recovery programs, but programs that are currently in existence can get recovery funds, and suddenly you're under the requirements before you even knew it.
And Christine, does the platform from Microsoft Dynamics, is that able to take into account all of these new ARRA requirements? Because as Rich mentioned, you need even separate accounting codes, because even if it's an existing program using old dollars, once those new dollars from stimulus come in, they have to be counted separately. How does the product help with all that?
Well, Tom, the platform is very flexible, and we've seen different opportunities to make changes, as well as the ability for executives to get at the data to analyze how their business is really doing. So, yes, I would say that's definitely one of the strengths of the solution.
And Rich, earlier you were talking about how the spending by the federal government brings new regulations, and among those regulations is accounting for every dollar under stimulus. Another regulation is to try to encourage use of small business. And
right.
So what are the specific opportunities? How can small businesses that may not have done federal work get a toehold in there?
We did mention earlier that one of the avenues for getting past performance is by subcontracting under a larger prime contractor. And that's really where I see most of the small businesses getting their toehold, so to speak.
Subbing.
Yes. Becoming a sub for a larger company. Now, the SBA has programs that they are trying to promote to allow set-asides of certain contracts. And that's what they term them, set-asides, because they're designed for only being allowed to bid if you're a small business. Those still have the same requirements of the larger contracts. There used to be, on the order of about 4 years ago, some reporting benefits that the smaller businesses would get alleviated requirements. Those have all gone away. And so you're under the same requirements whether you're a big business or a small business. But the SBA is still promoting that. Now, the other thing on the side of this is that the SBA, through the federal government with all agencies, negotiates a percentage of small business contracting that they have to reach on an annual basis, or that they agree to reach on an annual basis, I should say. And so every agency is looking for opportunities to focus at least some contracting so they meet their percentage requirements, whatever those were agreed to be at the beginning of the year.
And so, Bernard, does having a small partner help you find your way in, or can you be the small partner to someone larger as your way in?
Well, I think that the small business needs to have some strategic advantage. When they go to a prime contractor, the prime is looking at them as a valuable partner. So whether it's a contact with a government agency, whether it's some technical capability, whether it's your network, it has to be some real advantage that you bring to the prime. And with that advantage, then the prime can help you really to grow your business by providing resources, even whether it's a mentor program or what have you, to be able to grow into a particular agency.
Now, regardless of whether you're large or small, suppose you have been offering products and you decide and you've made the strategic decision that, yeah, I want to be in the services business. I really know this stuff. What else do you have to do to prepare the customer other than say, hey, guess what? I'm now in services. Must be more strategic than that. Tell us about that, Bernard.
Right. So I think the first thing that you know a company should do is really look at their capabilities and look at where they want to go long term. And if they want to get, you know, move from being a product company to a services, they really have to put in place the infrastructure. So it may require some additional technical capability, different accounting staff, even additional software. Those things need to be considered up front. They need to really look at how they would provide that service to the agency to make sure that they're competitive with whoever else is in a market. And then, be cautious that this is a organizational change. They need to make sure that they understand that and put in place the structure to make that occur.
And Rich, I imagine the accounting systems that you have and other internal systems would have to change because the way you account and bill for services might be very different from the way you do those functions for products.
Yeah, absolutely. As we did mention earlier, where products are focused on a single delivery point and a billing, services are often over a period of time. And as they go over a period of time, billing incrementally can be very important. When you're dealing with employees, you're dealing with payrolls that hit on a very regular basis, and you can't miss those. They're timely, and there's no leeway. So the financing opportunities or financing requirements that you're under, even as a small business going into services, have to be very focused.
And would you say that you need to be able to demonstrate that new capability that you have internally to the customer to help them gain confidence that you can deliver?
Yes, you do. And as a matter of fact, most contracts that require services are focused on the financial ability to handle the contract. So you need to demonstrate that you have the financial wherewithal to handle the size of contract that you're going after. And so even those that are pointed towards small, they know that they can't set up a company that doesn't have the financial capability to handle an employee base. And so you have to demonstrate that up front. And it's one of the things they look at in that 1408 that I mentioned earlier. One of the 15 points is, do you have the financial capability to handle the contract?
And Bernard, I think when we were talking about DCAA, that question came up about DCAA last year. Do they understand what the capabilities in that sense are of the suppliers that they were auditing, the contracts they were auditing? Were they fully aware of the capabilities of the contractors? Because sometimes they weren't, and that's where they went off the rails a little bit.
Right. And so that's why it's important for a product company to have consultants that are working with them, because it's a different view when you work in DCA from incurred cost submission, your indirect costs or provisional rates. And, you know, you need to have that expertise so that you don't get any misunderstandings or misconceptions with DCA.
And Chris, can you use a product like Microsoft Dynamics, that's the heart of what you're offering? Can that also be shown or demonstrated as saying, yeah, we have the system capability needed to be in compliance with all the all the regulations you're going to face in facing the government with that whole product offering.
Sure. Yeah, Tom, absolutely. We have, as I mentioned before, pretty unique benefits to contractors. Not only can we handle products and services, but also if they happen to have a commercial business, we can ensure that that business is kept segregated from the federal business within the accounting system, do consolidations, do really deep analysis on those individual businesses and help them be more successful.
And Christine, if you are moving into this area of dual capability, services mm-hmm. and products, what do you have to do to your own internal IT systems to beef up to be able to do that? Do you need to make more investments? And I mean, what do you have to do?
Well, I guess from a platform perspective, Dynamics Nav is not very IT intensive, very, I think, standard requirements, SQL Server. It's not even very costly relative to other solutions that are out there. So,
and Bernard, we'll have the final comment from you. Does that sound like your experience that whatever you have for one in terms of IT infrastructure, you're probably good to go to move into services or products, whatever the other one is, because of the efficiency of the Dynamics platform?
Absolutely. If you use Microsoft Dynamics NAV, you don't need to really get additional hardware or software. The system has the ability to handle both kinds of service offerings.
Well, that is great. I think that brings us to the conclusion of the discussion. We want to thank our panelists, Bernard Mustafa from Pleasant Valley Business Solutions, Rich Marksbury from ROM Associates, and Christine Zamuda from Microsoft Public Sector. And we want to thank you for listening to GovCon Straight Talk Show, sponsored by Microsoft, here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Microsoft's GovCon Straight Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any portion of the show, you can listen to the show in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com.
Microsoft Dynamics is a powerful financial management solution for government contractors. This accounting solution is designed for forward-thinking executives who are interested in more than just meeting DCAA, FAR, and CAS requirements. It is compliance plus. Integrated, easy to use, works the way you do. Microsoft Financial Management Solutions for Government Contractors. You now have a choice in the marketplace. Put simply, Microsoft Dynamics is Compliance Plus. Visit DynamicsByMicrosoft.com to learn more.
In Depth with Francis Rose, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Want to know how Congress is affecting your agency's staffing and budget? Want to learn more about the relationship between your agency and its contractors? In Depth helps you become a better manager by exploring the best ways to manage projects, manage your workforce, and manage yourself. In Depth with Francis Rose, weekday afternoons from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal news and information just got more fun and interesting. Amy Morris joins Tom Temin on The Federal Drive, weekday mornings from 6 to 10. Tom and Amy tailor their show for Feds on the Go with usable information from trustworthy and seasoned journalists. You're going to learn, but they also might make you laugh. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Amy Morris, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Video teleconferencing solutions are changing the way people communicate by breaking down the walls and enabling face-to-face communication, regardless of distance or environment. Tanberg developed Break Down the Walls to provide a window into the ways government, education, and healthcare organizations are using VTC solutions to help them operate more effectively and efficiently, and the ways video solutions can be used to address challenges facing public sector organizations today. Learn more at breakdownthewalls.com.
This is the sound of a data center. While all data center networks might sound alike, they're not. You see, most are horribly complex and expensive to manage. Now this is a Juniper network. Hear the difference? That's the sound of Juniper's simplified, automated, and secure solutions efficiently humming along, delivering you better performance at lower costs using less power. Music to my ears, and proof that while all data center networks might sound alike, they don't all work alike. Juniper Networks. Learn more at thenewnetworkishere.com.
This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Larry Allen of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Larry speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Larry Allen.
We are back on the industry side today after having had a couple of government guests recently here on Off the Shelf. I'll introduce my guest in a minute, but before I do that, I want to recognize the fact that we are now about five and a half months into the year 2010. Government markets continuing to mature. Hopefully you on the government contracting side are enjoying some of the benefits of the fiscal year. It's getting to be prime buying season. Enjoy it now. Next year may be a slightly different story. We've been talking a little bit about that here on Off the Shelf, and we're going to talk about it some more. If you have a suggestion for a show topic on the budget or another issue you'd like to see us cover here on Off the Shelf, drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address here at the station is offtheshelf@federalnewsradio.com. I'm pleased to welcome back a repeat offender here on Off the Shelf. He is Sandy Ho. Sandy is partner at the Washington firm of McKenna Long & Aldridge, where he is, I think, the managing director of your government contract practice. Is that right?
I head up our Washington, D.C. Government contracts practice.
And I'm happy to have you back on the show, Sandy. Great to have you here on Off the Shelf.
Thank you.
We're going to talk to Sandy Ho this half hour a little bit about a recent draft policy memo that was put out by the Obama administration on the subject of inherently governmental function. Those of you all who have been participating in the government market, whether you're a contractor or government employee, know that the subject of inherently governmental function is not a new one. It's been around for at least the past 25 years and been looked at in various ways. Now, however, we have a new draft policy memo out that seeks to not necessarily fundamentally redo the subject of inherently governmental, but certainly look at it through a fresh lens. In fact, Sandy, this has been a hot topic pretty much since the start of the Obama administration, and the recent draft policy letter was anticipated itself for over a year. Give our listeners some background on the issue and what makes an area, what makes it an area of high interest.
Larry, as you indicated, this has been an issue that goes back many, many, many years. The question of who performs what work for the government, be it government contractors or employees of the federal government. It recently played out during the two Bush administrations through OMB Circular A76 and the whole question of competing functions that the government historically has performed, putting it out for competition to contractors. Lots of controversy, a very political issue between the contractor community and the government labor unions. And then late in the Bush administration and leading to the new Obama administration, the subjects of Iraq and Afghanistan took hold. Much discussion, as everyone remembers, about the extent of the use of contractors in the battlefield and the inevitable subjects of fraud, waste, and abuse, leading the Obama administration politically to take the view that the subject of who performs work, be it contractors or government employees, be reviewed. And that was an early push in the Obama administration. In March of 2009, the president put out a memorandum that identified this issue as something that his administration would pursue and would examine, asked OMB to look at that subject, requested a determination or at least a definition of inherently governmental functions that would not be put out for contract by September of last year. That took additional time, and we currently have now in the last month the policy statement from OMB attempting to define more precisely what constitutes an inherently governmental function that must remain within the government workforce.
What's at stake here? If you're a government contractor and you're performing a lot of support services for the government, this policy letter and some of the intent behind it could lead to more insourcing by the government potentially. Give us, I'll give our listeners some idea of what the parameters are of this issue.
The federal government in fiscal year 2009 contracted out work totaling about $523 billion. Not all of that was service contracting.
Right.
But a good portion of it, an increasing portion, was service contracting. So some portion of that business is now open for bringing work back inside the government. Within the Department of Defense, interestingly, in fiscal year 2009, 39% of the workforce was made up of contractors.
Right.
DOD has indicated in the next 5 years they intend to reduce that number to 26%. That's a substantial reduction.
13% reduction at the same time. We're going to be bringing new people in to both to new functions, so it's going to be a situation very much in flux, right?
Exactly. And the real push here with this policy statement and the Obama administration overall is to reduce the number of contractors to stem the flow of work in the Bush administration to outside contractors and bring some of that work back in-house. So there's a lot of dollars involved and a lot of risk, if you will, to contractors having work that they currently are performing brought in-house. And as you say, new work coming up that will not be available for contractors.
So, right. And new things that might have gone out will now maybe stay inside. But Sandy, this begs the question, does the government have the ready-made infrastructure to do the work that they're talking about bringing in-house? I mean, let's kick that off now, and we'll get more into it later.
Well, that's a big question, and even this OFPP policy guidance that we're talking about today
right.
Recognizes that is an issue for the government. One of the emphases of the new policy is on post-award management of work that has gone outside to contractors. And as I'm sure your listeners know, the acquisition workforce within the government has been the focus of lots of attention over the last several years. So that's a big question.
A big question, one I want to delve in a little bit more with my guest today. He is Sandy Ho, a attorney here in Washington, D.C. with the law firm of McKenna Long and Aldridge. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what this policy letter is and what it means in terms of being a function of administration statement. You're listening to Off the Shelf here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Throughout the history of American defense, Northrop Grumman has helped give the men and women of our military an edge with innovative design. Northrop Grumman delivered the products and systems that changed the course of battles and of wars. Today, our technology makes a difference in every domain. Air, land, sea, space, and cyberspace. The people of Northrop Grumman build satellites, unmanned systems, electronic systems, information technology, as well as submarines and ships. We build the systems that give our troops a moment-by-moment picture of the battle space and a critical war-fighting advantage, along with shields from enemy threats. For 70 years, wherever the American military has served, Northrop Grumman has supported our nation's and our allies' defenses with the most advanced technology. Northrop Grumman, defining the future.
And welcome back here to Off the Shelf, where I am Larry Allen, your humble host here every Tuesday morning at this precise time here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, where we discuss the very latest developments in the world of commercial solutions procurement with leaders in and out of government. We are talking this week to somebody who's outside of government, currently anyway. We'll get back to our guest in a minute. But first, I want to remind you, our loyal listeners, that on Off the Shelf, we endeavor to bring you the very latest. But if you're looking for the latest in the world of government procurement, check out the Coalition's own website. It is thecgp.org. That's thecgp.org. And it will probably tell you more than you ever could possibly want to know about what's happening in the world of commercial solution procurement policy. My guest this half hour is Sandy Ho. Sandy is a partner with the Washington, D.C. law firm of McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And our subject this half hour is the recent administration draft policy guidelines on what constitutes inherently governmental. And Sandy, as we went into that last break, I promised our listeners that we would talk a little bit about the instrument that the administration has used to initiate this discussion. It is a draft policy letter. It's not a rule, it's not a regulation, yet it did appear in the Federal Register for comment. Help our listeners understand a little bit what a draft policy letter is and where it falls in the continuum of regulatory actions.
A draft policy letter is something short of a regulation. To contrast, a regulation that goes through the formality of promulgation by the government has the force and effect of law, to speak in legalistic terms. Generally means that a party, in this case either a contractor or a government employee, would have the ability to seek in the courts enforcement of that statement if they believed it was not being followed. Policy statement is not of the same character, doesn't have the same stature. It is an internal government directive to the agencies, executive agencies of the federal government. But if some party felt aggrieved because it was not followed, the courts are not going to recognize a right of that party to enforce it. But it does have very persuasive effect on the executive branch itself. If an agency fails to follow the policy, at least internally within the government, they're going to have to answer to the director of OMB.
Answer to OMB on it, particularly if you're one of the high-ranking political people in a specific government agency. Could this, Sandy, lead to some sort of regulation? Sounds like a policy letter, particularly a draft policy letter, is a very initial de minimis type of step to outline something. Do these things lead to regulatory language and down the road? Could we see that here?
Yes. The outcome of this debate that has been kicked off by the policy letter certainly has every prospect of finding its way ultimately into the federal acquisition regulation. Even the policy letter recognizes that at some point the outcome of this policy process and the public discussion could lead to regulations. Currently, the FAR, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, does have language that came into being several years ago in Part 7 of the FAR that does discuss the question of inherently governmental functions and closely related functions to the inherently governmental work. So that would be a logical final home for whatever the outcome is of this the debate that's been kicked off by this policy letter.
So we could expect to see more here. That's kind of an alert, I guess, for contractors down the road. The policy letter itself, Sandy, defined inherently governmental along the lines of the 1998 FAIR Act definition. This was a definition that was put in place originally with a different purpose at the time towards maximizing the possibility of outsourcing. How do you think the administration could interpret this definition differently from its predecessors? Is there really that much leeway in the definition? what is going to come out of FAIR Act, why the FAIR Act definition and not something else?
The challenge for the federal government going back, certainly previous to this policy letter and even back to the FAIR Act, has been trying to come up with a definition that has sufficient specificity that it is usable by the federal government in determining what functions are inherently governmental and therefore not subject to contracting out and which functions are not. I don't think that this policy letter substantially changes that challenge. The concept of what's inherently governmental is almost by definition difficult to establish. The policy letter is the latest attempt to define that. Interestingly, like its predecessors, this policy letter uses examples to try to make the definition more concrete. The examples they've used are directly out of the Federal Acquisition Regulation and have been in the FAR for several years now. Yes, is there room for interpretation? certainly. It's a very difficult concept. I think the real interesting part here is what does an agency do now after this policy letter or after whatever regulations are implemented because of the policy letter once it goes through the process of examining a function that's outlined in this policy letter. The Bush administration focus was on looking to contract out through the competitive sourcing process. The Obama administration's focus appears to be to keep more work in-house.
Bring it back in. And there are some different shades of gray here, aren't there? Because we're talking about things that are inherently governmental, and that's the stuff that definitely is performed by government. But there's also this next area, critical function, and that's a function that if you talk to a lot of people I speak to, sometimes they say, well, that could be performed in-house, but it could be performed by government or by a contractor, rather, as long as there is sufficient oversight. One sentence, good idea, bad idea, how do we decide?
I think the concept makes good sense. The critical function is one that is currently defined in the policy letter as an area where the government needs to have in-house some functions. Don't give it all to contractors. They can go away. You need the institutional knowledge. I think a good idea to focus on that area.
Good idea to focus on that area. And I want to thank Sandy Ho for being in the studio with me. We have him around for just a little while longer. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk to him a little bit about what could happen during the comment period on this draft policy letter and what changes we might see to a FAIR Act definition of inherently governmental as a result of this exercise. I'm Larry Allen. You're listening to Off the Shelf right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What do successful small, medium, and large federal contractors, including two-thirds of the top 100, have in common? Membership in the Coalition for Government Procurement. Successful federal contractors know they get the information edge they need on developing acquisition trends and an effective voice to protect their interests from coalition membership. For nearly 30 years, the coalition's been the trusted voice of industry, working with federal officials to promote common sense procurement. Know what the best know. Join the coalition today to protect and grow your company's business. Contact the Coalition at 202-331-0975 or visit their website at thecgp.org. That's 202-331-0975 or thecgp.org. Don't be left wondering what will happen to your federal business in 2009. Contact the Coalition today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf, where I am Larry Allen, president of the Coalition for Government Procurement, and your host here on Off the Shelf, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, where every week we endeavor to bring you, the listener in government and industry, the very latest developments in the world of commercial solutions procurement. We endeavor to bring you guests from senior levels of government and industry. And we've been talking this half hour to Sandy Ho, a titan of the legal profession in Washington, particularly if Washingtonian magazine's ratings are to be believed. And a repeat offender here on Off the Shelf, as I mentioned at the outset of the show. We're happy to have Sandy back with us. We're talking with him this half hour about inherently governmental function in a draft policy letter that was issued in April by the Obama administration, talking about who gets to perform what types of government functions, what is appropriate to be performed by contractors, what should be bought back in-house and performed by government, and where you draw the line. Sandy, as we went into that last break, I promised the listeners a discussion about what could happen during the comment period, or rather really as a result of the comment period, to the initial FAIR Act definition issued in the draft policy letter. Some people might say that if you're looking at it from the contractor perspective, hey, FAIR Act definition is probably as good as you can hope to get, guys. It may just go slip from a contractor's perspective backwards from here. Where could a new definition take us? What are your views on some of the things that could potentially change after the comment period, depending on the comments received?
I think that the attempt to define inherently governmental in this policy letter is a Herculean effort, if you will.
Right.
And I think industry and any other commentators will be hard put to convince OMB and OFPP that they can further define what is or is not inherently governmental. The current administrator, Dan Gordon, is a gentleman known to many of us throughout the years during his time at GAO. Very thoughtful, very well-balanced. I have no doubt that this policy statement came from a great deal of thought on his part and his staff. I think the real question is going to be after this policy statement is implemented, I suspect with likely few changes to the definition, what the agencies are going to do with it and what they're going to be pressured to do.
Right. That's a good point. Elaborate on that a little bit.
The a policy statement, particularly one that involves a subject that's so difficult to capture as inherently governmental, is an indicator of a direction that a group wants to go, in this case, the Obama administration. Under the Bush administration, it was clear competitive sourcing and outsourcing was the desired result. In this administration, politically, it's clear keeping work in-house or insourcing is the saying of the day.
Right.
So I think it will be clear after this policy statement is ultimately implemented to the executive branch that in the case of any doubt, the decision should be made to keep the work in-house rather than seek outside contractors.
Right. And what type of timeline are we looking at potentially here? The comment period, I guess, closes in June. So those of you all who are listening and want to submit comments, you have till that time. But just when the comment period closes doesn't mean we have a draft or a final the next day. What type of timeline are we looking here, Sandy, and when might we expect to see some changes?
I think the best prognostication at this point is the fall. That would give OMB and OFPP the summer, 3-4 months to consider whatever comments they've received and then finalize the document.
So we could see something coming out, and then that would be the 2010 episode for this and perhaps a 2011 regulatory episode coming soon to a inherently governmental function near you. Sandy, in the time we have left, let's try to put this issue in perspective with another one of the administration's pending policy changes, the so-called high road option that could require government agencies to give a preference for companies that have superior labor wage and employee benefit packages. Could this even be a more significant change or requirement than the definition of inherently governmental? And if we have time, what do these changes taken together tell us about the administration views of contractors and contracting?
The so-called high road option is, I think, for those of us on the contractor side, a very unusual, aggressive policy to consider. It, in my mind, kind of goes to the heart of government procurement as we know it.
Right.
The concept of awarding on the basis of lowest cost or on the basis of best value, where price is plays a significant factor. I think this high road option would undermine or question that whole basis even more so than the inherently governmental issue.
Potentially it's much more significant then.
And I think it's more. I think it will be more significant. I think it
costs
challenges
to government, as you say, fundamentally redoes the underlying precepts of what constitutes sound government acquisition.
It is certainly been a function of government procurement over Republican, Democratic administrations to use contracting as a social engineering device.
Good point.
We have
not new territory here.
Not new territory, but in my mind, this one would go directly, more so than some of the other policies, to really the inner functioning of the contractor. The contractor is looked upon as the entity whose function it is to organize itself in a way that's cost effective and provides best value. This high road option would be suggesting, if not requiring, that contractors adjust their labor principles and their labor approaches in a way that would be viewed as favorable to the government, but may not be consistent with their general business plans.
So we're going to have to wait and see. This has been a much rumored policy, but we haven't actually seen anything come out on it yet. Although there have been some significant leaks, it could be a real interesting issue for people to sink their teeth into, because it potentially could affect not just a company's government business, but maybe all of its business.
Precisely. And it, as I say, it does, in my mind, go to the heart of why the government looks to contractors for its innovation, for its management of its labor and its other capital assets. And this would amount to, in one shape or form, a directive from the government that certain labor policy should be followed.
Should be carried forth. Well, Sandy Ho from McKenna Long and Aldridge, great guest as always. I want to thank you for coming back to talk about this issue. Look forward to having you and some of your colleagues back here on Off the Shelf sometime soon. I want to thank you, our loyal listeners, for coming, listening to us today on this issue. I'm Larry Allen. Join us again next week when we continue our discussions in the world of commercial solutions procurement right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Larry Allen of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. WFED, your source for federal news now.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss
discuss best practices and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy Midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics and your source for federal news now.
CNN Radio, I'm Jim Ribble. Top story this hour, oil company executives are getting it from both barrels at a Capitol Hill hearing. They're on the Hill to explain safety procedures on their drilling rigs, but Congressman Ed Markey's made up his mind.
The oil industry has invested nearly zero time and money into developing safety and response efforts.
The executives say the country would become more dependent on foreign oil and Gulf economies would suffer if Congress...